Just go.
Eric.
Hey, Charles.
Sorry, man. You're all smiley today.
Yeah,
what's going
of course.
On?
You know, it's like beautiful weather outside in Seattle. Uh-huh. So, yeah. So I have to do something to compensate for the weather.
Excellent. So we're in Red West today for another E2E. What's going on?
Yeah, so we're here with Gur. And, you know, I guess everybody has used, you know, Virtual Earth. And where life is much better than here in the real world. So, and Gur is the kind of, you know, the guy behind that. So
One of the guys behind it. It's a group effort. Many people worked on it. Actually, at some point, as many as 600 people. So it's a big effort.
Nice.
Wow. So can you tell us a little bit like about, you know, Virtual Earth and the guy, maybe its history, where did it come from, and then, you know, where do you see it go in the future?
The meaning of life. Yes,
I can try
to give the meaning of life. So Virtual Earth started unofficially a long time ago in two projects. There was something called MapPoint, which the MapPoint team created. If you guys use Street and Trips, then you remember that actually still exists. Microsoft Bing's hardware. We have this GPS pack.
Oh, which, I have that. Yes,
which actually works really well. Nice little competition for Garmin. I don't know how it does this year, but for the last couple of years, it had about 70%, 80% market share in laptop navigation.
Wow!
So actually, it's successful. This little product makes us a lot of money. So there was the team doing that for a long time, and there was a research project under Microsoft Research done by Tom Barclay called TerraServer. Tom Barclay is another guy that if you haven't interviewed, you definitely should. Basically, was looking for places to make SQL fall down from all the data. Mm. And he was looking around, and one day he found all the aerial imagery. So he's got a funny, amazing story how he licensed all the data from the Russians. Mm. And, you know, it's lots of Russian pixels, and they created Terra server, which was the first terabyte SQL server. And it was
which now sounds amazing, right? I mean, you buy a terabyte for $99 now. So
it's amazing. Well, at the time, it was one of the largest sort of databases ever created.
Yeah.
And they were running with this in MSR for a very long time, mostly as an experimentation, but over time they had more functionality, open net web services and stuff like that, and working with the USGS to do mapping applications. And at the same time, Google made two quick acquisitions, one that got them Google Earth and the other one got them Google Maps. They're really two separate companies. Neither of these products was created inside Google. Although, to give them credit, they took the web mapping port and become Gmaps and said, okay, remove all the ActiveX controls and make it a lot more druggable and try to build an Ajax app. So this was a place where Google was innovating quite well. At the time, we really had three main sites that people were using for mapping. There was Yahoo, MapQuest by far, number one. Yahoo and MapPoint, which was us. Mm-hmm. There's also something called MapBlast. I don't know if you guys remember this.
No.
That actually was another acquisition called Vicinity that Microsoft did a few years back. So Microsoft sort of right there in the online mapping business, but the day Google Maps sort of released, everything changed, because once you could sort of drag and drop, it was very different. Now, of course, we always had the technology for very interactive, very dynamic mapping with directions and everything, but it was in a rich, set Win32 client. It wasn't on the web. Mm-hmm. So there was a paper written, and then orthogonally to this, there was a paper written called Virtual Earth that Alex Guarneros, who was at the time Bill's TA and now runs AdCenter, wrote. It was like a three-pager and said, imagine if you had mapping and search and flight simulator and what could happen. It was actually way ahead of his time. This was before Google Earth was doing any of these things. And I was finishing my work on unified communication at the time. I was looking for a new challenge, and I was always a geek of pixels, cameras, and GPSs. Mm. And this was like the perfect combination.
Yeah, right?
The MapPoint team said that we're doing this new thing. They already had the MapPoint web service, which was really for enterprise customers. I'll tell you about it in a second. And saying, okay, let's try to take this big sort of BTA challenge and run with it. I started with the team, I think, in December of 2004. We had a vision document submitted to Think Week. Mm-hmm. And around 2.5 months later, we had a review of Bill about a month after that with a demo. That was literally using the materials in the room. We can talk about using materials in the room. Well, that was whatever works. You just slap it together. Bill said, wonderful, ship it in 100 days. Come to me when it's running.
Really, is that what he said?
That literally is what he said. Anyway, it was about invasion. I don't think it's what he said verbatim, but the, yeah. We left the room and said, okay, guess clock is ticking. Mm-hmm. We have to ship this. And there was about 7 people involved in the beginning, grew to about 15, got shipped very quickly. I think we missed the deadline by like 9 days or something, but really did ship in 3 or 4 months. And that was version 1 of Virtual Earth. It was virtualearth.msn.com, which is sort of funny that I found myself in MSN again. And sort of things that they change very often, but they always come back to where they started. And from then on, sort of every 6 months, every 4 to 6 months, we did a major release. The releases had names. So the first one, we didn't have an A release. That was the build demo. Then we had a bigger release, which was the LV1 and Calypso. They're all ships. And at some point, we decided there must be ships with 6 characters, which is the same as Google. So that became very complicated, hideous, and you know, trying to find the right names. Anyway, so Jupiter was, I think, the latest one. And you know, it depends on the spelling, it doesn't exactly get right. It was a geeky little game we're playing. There was a lot of innovation in the platform. I think a big part of it is because we tried to engineer, at least to my knowledge, the first time in Microsoft, instead of trying to figure out what the software needs and getting the right hardware, was doing the reverse. Saying, okay, let's think about the return on investment, sort of the end-to-end cost to operate, to host, to you know, to develop, and sort of build them to each other. Mm-hmm. We were very lucky to have our own operations team, which was both sort of very unusual for Microsoft, that allowed us some flexibility, and we actually worked with Rackable to build some custom servers just for us. And it ended up that, you know, about a couple of years later, we found out what Google was investing in terms of just number of servers to operate the same sort of infrastructure. We between a magnitude of 2 in just the sheer number of servers. And when you think about manageability and cost of operations and just the other cost equation to operating a large online services, which is the data center itself, that's huge. Most people forget that you let's say you pay $10,000 for a server, there's another $10,000 that goes into the real estate to put the server in. And then when you probably pay over the 3 or 4 times, 5 years of the lifetime of the server, you pay probably 3 or 4 times that amount. So every time you said, oh, it's just, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 servers, like, no, it's a lot of money that you're sort of just not visible. These data centers cost $250 million each, right? And one of them fills up, you have to go and write $250 million check to buy a new data center.
So kind of, you know, maybe I would like to kind of drill down a little bit into this thing, because when I, as a kind of naive user, kind of used a mapping thing in my browser or whatever, I have no clue that there's like, you know, a whole kind of data center behind it to kind of serve up the maps and so on. So maybe, you know, can be on the whiteboard, can you kind of sketch a little bit what is the architecture of the thing? And
I'll do something else.
Yeah, you don't have to kind of, you know, spill any kind of secrets here, but...
They're not secrets. I mean, this is actually, at this point, we actually did some of these presentations out in the industry, in ACM, GIS, and stuff like that. So people tend to know what we're working. Look, there's generally 2 types of web services. There are people who do the traditional 3 or 4 tier architectures, and sort of they build application servers and clients and try to figure out where the state is. We actually did something very different. We presumed from day one that we have an AJAX app. So it really doesn't matter if, you know, if it's a rich Win32 or today in Silverlight is just fantastic, right? It's the best of both worlds, or just JavaScript. But there's state and there's logic in the client, and we leverage it from day one. So once you allow yourself to do it, you end up with sort of these reverse pictures. You have an AJAX app, and then you have a bunch of application silos underneath it. And you try to scale them completely independently of each other. Right, and when you think about an architecture looks like this, you know, and I'm not even saying where the line between the internet client technology and the serving technology or the content distribution is wrong, right? It's sort of orthogonal, but it's important to think about the world where you have intelligence in the edge. You can actually make the web service a lot more scalable by making each component not have any cost dependencies with every other component. Right, there is no state on our servers. The only session state that you actually have is in actual storage, right? And we use MSN storage today. Down below, it's actually accessed almost directly. There's a box, you know, there's a class of servers that talk to it. The geo community, if you use collections, that's actually how it gets done. But then all these services are independent, and we have the tile service. Right? This is where all the images, all the pixels come from, but it's more than that. We have geocoding. Right? So if you need to translate an address to a lat long or lat long to address, you have driving directions, so I need to get from A to B. You have an index service, or right? And there's a number of these, right? There's the Monarch, which is text first, which is really the search index. There's a section of it called feeds.
Okay.
We have Yellow Pages data. So when you search for pizza in Seattle, then Seattle gets geocoded, and then pizza comes from this index. Okay? But it's actually interesting. This is done sort of very independently, and these systems operate, and they scale independently. Mm. And you get to optimize them independently.
And so the state, so how is that kind of shared? So does, you know...
It's just still.
It's just for
it's just on the client. There is no... The tile service is completely stateless. The geocoding... Everything here is completely stateless. Okay? There's some federators in here. We have something called, you know, the platform services that understands how to federate. So if you need to call multiple indexes or multiple backends, then we can do it. And the client doesn't actually need to understand this internal other thing. Mm. And the purpose of it is more to be able to call multiple things that are similar. So let's say you have three geocoders or you have three indexes and you want to do recall for all of them at once, but then rank across them. That allows you to do it. Not that we do that today, but at least gives us a place to do it. And remember that it's always, actually, this touches on what you've been working on for a long time. It touches on how much data can you move up to the client to do local computation, right? Because this is all an exercise in efficient windowing, right? In theory, if I can get you exactly the right set of pixels to get you the perfect view, then I don't need to send that much data. The screen resolution is not that high. The issue is that I need to send you, I don't really know what you're going to look at. I don't know where you're going. You know, if you're in 3D, I don't know which direction you're going to turn the camera. So you have to either fetch too much data or you have to let the user suffer the consequences of sort of bad predictions. And the index is the same thing. If I could just take the entire 25 or 50 million businesses in the US today and upload them to the client, then you can search for it very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. But every time I have to sync this huge database to you, right? Okay, so I don't.
Yeah.
And you go into windowing mechanism, rank recall, whatever. Mm-hmm. So the question is, where do you run the algorithm? Sometimes you want to run the algorithm as close to the data. Sometimes you want to run the algorithm as close to the user. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is no single answer. Anyway, there's many things that sort of are interesting here. The next one that's sort of important is understanding failure modes.
Okay, yeah. And so before you kind of, you know, completely erase that, so like these services, are they kind of geo-distributed? So
no.
So they're all kind of here or in...
So I'll ask you, and I'll do this. This is a standard exercise. People who know me know that I always ask the same question, at least once to everybody. So you're driving down the road, okay? And you see a traffic light really far away, and it's green. Mm-hmm. You're the only one there, driving above the speed limit, okay? This is not your destination. You may have many more traffic lights to hit before you get to your destination. Do you accelerate, do you accelerate, decelerate, or you keep the same speed? What do you do?
Well,
I know you design. I know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay,
for me, the point of no return is kind of, you know, pretty far, you know. So I'm pretty
close.
So you
accelerate.
You didn't give me enough things to work with. I would play around with, you know, time. Time travel?
So
I'd play around with, like, what kind of car do I have? I mean, how fast can I go?
The interesting point is what you optimize for. So Eric optimizes to time on arrival, so you always accelerate.
Yes.
Sounds like you'll optimize for efficiency.
Yeah.
And you may sometimes say, I don't care, let me get that 10 minutes later, but I'm going to optimize for my carbon footprint.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, it's green,
So I want to preserve time. Yeah. Time is a valuable resource. Don't waste it.
Well, that's why you should kind of accelerate.
All right. You know, that's not a bad idea.
Okay, so, but the interesting point, you both chose to optimize. Many people say, we don't know, therefore we keep the same speed.
Yes.
But the point is, you have to pick what you optimize for. You always have to pick. If you don't optimize, then you fail to anyone else who does optimize.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, but to segue here, right, this is all about optimizing the delivery, right? And to this date, we actually optimize for cost. It's very expensive to push all these assets over to the edge. You need, Google has 25 data centers and have a footprint in each one of them. Mm-hmm. And in terms of capacity, you don't need that many data centers. Well, it depends what you optimize for. We chose to optimize for money. And even then, when we launched about 4 years ago, we had much better performance than Google. Over the last 18 months, Google created so many data centers and turned on cognitive distribution that actually the performance became something that not optimizing for wasn't appropriate at any time.
Mm.
Just recently, I think this is last release, must have been sort of the last month, we turned on ECN. ECN is the Edge Compute Network from GFS.
Okay.
It's actually a Microsoft internal service. And all the tiles that you see on VirtualDAO today comes from ECN. There's about 10 and growing to 20 sites across the world. So we're dropping from an average of, let's say, 100 milliseconds away in the US to 2.5 seconds in Australia. Mm. I apologize personally for Australia. We really didn't care about you for a very long time. We're now dropping to an average of 20 to 50 milliseconds across the world, anywhere in the world, which is really nice. But again, point is, we optimize for one thing, which is cost of delivery, and we shifted to optimize for something different.
Okay.
But that exercise, by the way, forces you to think about many things. Right? I mean, not optimizing is not an option.
I was surprised Eric didn't say, you know, write a functional program, stick it in my car, let it figure it out.
Artificial intelligence.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. So let's talk about that.
So there's interesting sort of things that we learned along the way. I think one of the numbers that I was really surprised with when I joined Microsoft, that it was similar to other companies outside Microsoft, is how much of our code do we rewrite between major releases. I think someone in 2003 did some post-mortem Windows. I can't remember which numbers, so don't catch me in the actual statistics. But they said that about 60% of Windows gets rewritten between major releases, so in a 3 to 5 year lifetime. I don't know if it's still true today, but apparently some statistic from the history. And when you allow yourself to think that way, then the cost of innovation by making mistakes, learning, and then rewriting is not that huge.
Yeah.
But especially early on, right? If there's no code to be written, if you didn't write any code yet, it doesn't really matter what code you're writing. That's sort of interesting. As long as you know that you have some bandwidth to go and fix it later, and you acknowledge these learnings early. We, just on the tile system, that sort of thing that I do here on the left, right? And I probably need to acknowledge that Tom Barkley, Josh Schwartz, and Marcus Jensen, the three people who sort of did most of the work there. I mostly randomized them by coming up with insane ideas, saying, you must do more. But in that tile system, we probably went over 3 or 4 major architectures. The first model had like this, super hot and warm and cold layout, and trying to be geo-distributed. Then we moved to some other model, and today there's actually a front-end and back-end system, right? Where the front-end does caching. We call them the TFEs, and there's clusters of TBEs behind them. And these actually store the pixels, and these just route, and everybody's connected to everybody else. And there's more of them. These are the units of scale in terms of storage, and these are the units of scale in terms of transactions, and we separate them. But then we found out something interesting. These things sit there, and they just smoke. They do nothing. It's all I/O, right? So the CPU is sitting there doing absolutely nothing. And these things sit there, and they store a lot, but they don't do very much. So you don't need a lot of memory. So then one of the developers came and said, hey, I can do composition here. CPU is not doing anything anyway. Mm. So that little insight wasn't me, by all means, right? I don't know who it was. Someone's in Flow in Marcus, I think, resulted in us not burning our labels into the tiles, but actually generating on the fly. There was a saving of 1/3 of our storage. Huge. Mm. Huge. When we say storage, we ship 50 terabytes a month of data.
Wow.
Okay, so that little, think about how can you affinitize and move, optimize the right way, save 1/3 of that.
Amazing.
Yeah, so very important. There's other interesting things we learned along the way. And then we found out that the search team was doing, reached almost the same conclusions independently, which is always nice. Like you learn something and you realize someone landed at the same destination. Yeah. There's some tool.
Yes, exactly. There's,
We went with 12 drives. This is a 12-drive machine, each of these nodes. They're actually rackable. If people care, these are the rackable 3U hub-depth back-to-back 3012 servers. That's not what we'll be using in the future because drives are getting too large. Mm. So this will be like a 24-terabyte machine, just too huge. By the time when we started, these were 400-gig drives or 250-gig drives, and they were just about the right size. So initial deployment in Terra servers, RAID 5. RAID 5 is beautiful, right? You have high yield. And you don't really care if you lose some of the drives. But it has this consequence that when you do lose a drive, the system goes into this zombie state, right? And just runs very slowly. So the obvious answer is right in like RAID 1. But RAID 1, you lose half your drive, so that's crazy. Mm-hmm. Okay, how about we run in RAID 0? Because RAID 0 is wonderful. If you lose any drive, you lose the entire disk, the entire machine, sorry, and you get tremendous I/O because both your reads and writes are sort of distributed across the entire array. So, but you get very low MTBF. So Of course, for if you have a couple of SQL servers and you're doing RAID 0, that's insane, because you'll need to move to like 6 or 10 or 12 SQL servers in a straight sort of software array to get the same MTBF. But remember that we're not just building small enterprise applications. We need to support hundreds of thousands of transactions per second. I think someone... We did the math once in one of the releases, and we can... The maximum scale, and this is only for small tiles because we hit the network boundary very quickly, we can output about 1.5 million tiles per second.
Wow.
Right. I think the average rate is about 300,000, actually. But that's huge. You know, tons of transactions per second, very large.
It's amazing.
But, again, what's the rate out of a single machine? Well, if it's RAID 0, it's, you know, these are cheaper SATA drives, you actually get like 1,500 IOs a second out of the RAID. And there's a nice property. There's no zombie mode. There's absolutely no zombie state. One, any drive fails, the entire thing just disappears off the planet of the Earth. It doesn't exist. And you need to have enough other ones, you know, to go recover from it. So there's just an exercise of how many transactions versus how many storage versus what reliability you want and how often do you need to walk the data center. And because you have enough capacity in each single machine to serve that tile, right, it's actually became very simple, right, very easy. The other interesting thing that happened, and so there's a bunch of people involved, each of these queries is actually broken into four VIPs. If you actually play fiddler logs on VE and you look at what the queries you make, you see T0, T1, T2, T3, which are the tiles. This forces IE to open, you know, 8 to 16 connections. That's very important. So there's a lot of pipeline going on. But it also allows us to stripe the request. So when you build a page, it actually comes with different clusters and different machines, right? So each of these map views actually can hit multiple servers at the same time. Right? So you imagine this is, you know, 0, 1, 2, right? Distributed, and each one of them come from different servers. These tricks actually are very simple, but they result in really high transaction rates. And this is sort of the interesting point. We, at some point when we went live, I think within 24 hours, we represented about 1/3 of Microsoft's overall traffic.
Wow.
We were about 90% of the web transactions hitting Microsoft.
Hmm.
Okay, we did it with, our go live number was less than 500 servers. Okay.
Amazing.
So it's really tiny when you think about it.
Yeah.
Right. All of VE today, end-to-end, is about 1,900 servers. Google has each drop of Google Maps on each of their data centers. I think the latest decks that they showed, I think they have 22, 25 data centers. It has over 15,000 servers.
So I have a question.
So it's like literally a couple of magnitudes away from where they are in efficiency.
So you mentioned your whole architecture is stateless. What I would ask is, since certain maps don't change over time, right? I mean, the Earth only has so many forms, and you know, the Earth isn't growing; it's not shrinking.
I just read that there's my wrong assumption. It's like, you know, it's rising.
So the Earth doesn't change, but humans change it all the time.
Of course,
the roads change, and we can never catch up with the rate of change.
So in other words, there would be no sense in like having sort of a velocity like distributed caching system, so that when you have similar requests coming, why do the computations again?
In theory, right, but there's an interesting formula that we use all the time. It's 85, 85, 85.
Okay.
There's actually another 85. So 85% of your users spend 85% of their time within 85 miles of where they work, play, right, or live.
Okay.
Really important. Okay, so this logical about 160, 170, radius peak circle that captures about 85% of what you care about. And no, it's not globally appropriate, right? But it's generally, when we look at it, it's not a magnitude bigger or a magnitude smaller.
Okay.
Right? And what this means is that you can actually cache about 85, if you're smart about your allocation strategies, right? And ECM, so the classic example of how we do it, at least for tiles. You can actually cache most 85% of the request to be served out of your region, right? Region potentially being a data server in this tiny little data center in Bellevue. But of course, data centers are huge, so you're not going to put a data center everywhere, and they cost $250 million. So about 2.5 years ago, we needed to go increase our compute capacity, and we had a couple of choices. Our compute servers were running in a lab in 119. There's some horrific stories around. The lab is a carpeted sort of raised floor lab, right? Not a raised ceiling lab, right? It's completely inappropriate to run a data center like lab. And we put about, I think, 5 or 8 racks there when we went live in the first version. And it immediately reached like 95 degrees and all the alarms went off and we just kept hitting the red button. And once a month, the security will come and audit us and say, we're shutting you down. And our GM, Stephen, like, I guess we'll send an email to Bill and then they won't shut us down. And, right. we had one weekend. This was beautiful. This was one of my favorite weekends early on. It must be in 2005, I think. Well, the Pacific PSE, I think, transformer on a corner of 40th and 148. If you walk next to Building 119, sitting out there, blew up. Literally, that thing blew up. Probably, I don't think it's a fault. I swear it's not my fault. Okay, but the lab shut down, and of course it's UPS enabled, so all the computers were connected to UPS, kept running, except the air condition wasn't. Okay, so the thing was heating up. Okay, what do you think happens when it gets above 120 degrees? Do you think it'll shut down the power? No, it's on two separate circuits, so the water sprinklers broke. Okay, so the entire thing just went and died, and and literally the Monday morning we had all the test managers just pulling servers and water is running out. So they went to, I think they went to Home Depot and bought these big giant industrial dryers and just ran them and opened all the servers, and I think we only lost like 5 servers, which was completely amazing. So no, it's completely inappropriate for labs. So when we look at scaling, we had an issue. We didn't want to do it in a lab. We wanted, a real space. But at the same time, we knew that moving to a data center is very expensive. Not for us, for Microsoft, right? It's just, you have to think hard about the impact of your decisions on operations and facilities. A lab space that was data center ready would have been about, I think, 17 million, then got negotiated down to 12. Data center space would have been non-existent, has to be built and provisioned, which was both time and resources. And Rackable at the time was building containers. They said, hey, we can just put a container out there. And unfortunately, the Rackable container wasn't really ready. Ferrari, which was a different vendor that we're now using, came back and said, we'll give you a container. And I said, no problem, just park it in the parking lot. Facilities in Redmond refused to take it, so we bought a small company in Boulder called Vexcel. And they owned the real estate. We said, you mind? And they said, yeah, hey, we'll just put it in the parking lot. So a little later, 3 containers, 60,000 pounds each, dropped in a parking lot, housing many servers each, 5,000 cores of computer, lots of storage, lots of terabytes. And they run for the last year and a half, they run the parking lot. And the cost of the containers with the server inside them, was less than the cost of the lab space to put the servers in.
So let me get this straight. You're saying that virtual earth is running in a parking lot?
The compute part. Not the serving part.
Got it.
So
the compute's what's the most important, man? I'm joking.
For some people.
I think so. I think it's the most
important. Garbage in, garbage out.
Okay.
This is the garbage in.
All right.
This is the garbage out. Right? It's critically important, and there's lots of work that happens there. But sometimes you just allow yourself to make crazy decisions, and they
right
work
on. Out, right? So to go back to your tiles here, so one of the things, right, when you're doing, at your geography class or whatever, they have all these kind of projections, right, of whatever maps onto the earth. So I wonder, does that kind of come into play? And especially when you have, pictures, like satellite pictures, what kind of projection do you use for them to kind of, map them on
the earth? We don't actually use that many satellites. Pictures. We use satellites where we can't fly a plane. So we have a group in Austria, Graz, beautiful city by the way, amazing group, who builds a camera. They also came in for an acquisition, the same company, Vexcel. They had two units, one in Boulder, Colorado, one in Graz, Austria. And we actually have a Microsoft camera, 280 megapixel, one frame per second, uncompressed, 5 channels including infrared. It's a $500,000 or €500,000 camera that Microsoft builds and sells. We actually make we make quite a lot of money on this.
Okay, so like a digital camera.
You know this. We are in the same place as Canon. You can't actually carry these things, but search for Ultracam, or Microsoft Ultracam, and you'll find it's an amazing piece of technology.
Excellent.
And, this truly goes back to the garbage in, garbage out. Right? Satellites have an issue. They fly on predetermined paths. They can't go around weather. So what they do is they look sideways, right? When they look sideways, and there's also, that's one issue, right? Which you can't really look around weather. You have to sort of, you don't get to pick your angle of view. The other issue, you fly specific times of day, so limited by exposure. And the final or biggest issue is that you're limited by the downlink of how much data you can get off the satellite, right? A single camera, a single one of these ultra cameras can generate, I think, 100 times the pixels on the same time as a single digital globe, which is sort of the satellite that powers most of Google Earth imagery. By the way, we have the same imagery on Virtual Earth today. But we use it outside the city cores and sort of where you can fly an airplane, so Sahara and China and North Korea, not going to fly an airplane with our camera. It's not our plane, it's not airplanes release. Then we'll use a satellite imagery. But for all the high interest and where we need high accuracy, then we actually have our own data. And it's totally garbage in, garbage out. Because the camera is ours and we can control it, and we know we can do quality control all the way from the photo sites on the sensor, which is built to our spec by a company called DALSA, all the way down to the pixels, showing on the TAL server. So if you need to do measurements, and it's very, very accurate. Well, more accurate than pixel.
And so you said in the beginning, that like the Earth kind of changes all the time. So how often do you refresh the pictures for like a certain site?
What do you optimize for? Coverage?
Yes, exactly. Yes. So that's the question.
Tom Barkley, which you're going to meet at some point, has the six C's of this color and clarity and, a bunch of them. Freshness, I don't remember what C used for freshness. Currency, I think, is critically key, but you also need coverage, right, which is another one of these C's. And what do you optimize for first? Right? We find that one of our biggest complaints is, hey, my road doesn't exist, or my road exists, but my house... you're showing a cornfield and actually this has been a neighborhood for the last 6 months. When are you flying me again?
Yes.
So there are many pixels in the
world,
right?
I think it probably depends, If you already have covered it, then people complain about, freshness. And if you don't,
can do justice to everybody.
Yeah.
I think part of it is that we're still trying to ramp up on the initial coverage. They're really... We don't have full coverage. Nobody has full coverage, right? The Earth at... just the Earth landmass... in 1 foot per pixel, which isn't very high resolution, we do much better today, is about 22 petabytes. Well, we're not even close. Nobody's even close to this, right? I mean, and not that you need the entire Earth's mass, right? How many pictures of sand do you actually need? Right? I mean, they're beautiful, but you don't need that many. I think the interesting point is where do you scale in different means, right? Where there's most change, you need to probably update most often. So the cornfields, do you really care that you have last year's cornfield or this year's cornfield?
Well, it might be if it's summer, you might want to have you want to have seasonal maps where it reflects the
Sure, the camera doesn't. It's very hard to take pictures of snow. Like this is the white horses running on a white snowy background. It doesn't work very well. It's great for modern art, but not really for photography. But seriously, I think you're sort of in an endless cycle, destructive cycle, because you very quickly realize that, okay, let's say Seattle changes, there's a 5% change rate that we actually monitor. We did this guy called Wolfgang in Boulder that did some investigation on this a couple of years ago. So Seattle changes about 5% every 2 years, and then we track this 5% change for all the major metro areas. Las Vegas, maybe not this year, changes 5% every 6 months.
Amazing.
Okay, so maybe you have to fly Las Vegas much more often than you fly Seattle, except that little piece of Steve Ballmer or something terrible, separate discussion. But you find that the street facades, right, the store facades, and what happened on the human scale changes even more often. So how often do the storefront change? Well, they probably change in a monthly cycle. And how often does the offers on the side, the coupons and stuff on the side of the stores actually change? Maybe on a weekly basis, right?
Sure.
And it's sort of, you're in a self-defeating cycle, right? It's impossible to capture everything. You need a business model that actually scales. Aha, ergo, you need something like PhotoSynth.
Yeah, I was wondering when that was going
to happen. Exactly. So you combine the head and the tail, right? I mean, this is really important.
There it is. It's living down there by the chair.
So there's a diagram that I think we draw a million times a year, which sort of looks like this, right? And we're saying head and tail and we're saying US, and maybe let's say just say UK or Japan or these big, let's just say rest of the world, right? And Microsoft too often, you know, will claim that we're as guilty as almost anyone else. We're sort of focusing on doing this because this is both high interest for what we care about. Mm-hmm. Most of us live and work in the US, and also is high revenue. This will probably represent somewhere between 40-60% of the worldwide revenue opportunity, depending on the market. Maybe less so. Europe is sort of very serious right now. But if you extend this a little bit, just like this, to include the EU, you're probably talking about 80-90% of the revenue potential. And it's very hard to think about anything else.
Hmm.
Right? But of course, you don't think about being personally relevant to people. Right? What if you live somewhere that's not really important? Well, what if you live in a country that's not generating enough revenue, right? I mean, that's sort of very self-defeating. So we actually make some business decisions, and then we try to fund them, you know, appropriately, which is always harder, right? We try to capture about 80% of the population of every country we commit to. 80% of the population doesn't represent 80% of the area, the landmass. It actually represents a lot less. Right, I mean, you're talking 5-20%, depending on where you are. Right, some European countries, you know,
sure,
actually higher percentages. So, and for the rest of the stuff, you go and try to license cheaper data, satellite. You know, we have the 10-meter Landsat data, which is terrible, but you know what? It's better than black, you know, or missing tiles.
Understood. But I want to, can I ask one question? Because I mean, from an academic or a theoretical standpoint, it's very interesting. But I would ask sort of, how useful is it, really, to be able to navigate and see what the top of your house looks like or the top of somebody else's house that you're trying to get to? I mean, what's the end game here? I mean, besides, it's like, yes, it's interesting that you're doing all this very interesting computation and sending down images.
I don't think there's one end game. I think there's a couple, right? First of all, you're trying to enable some new classes of applications.
Okay,
so you can imagine that applications today use geospatial data. Right, so you can think about Starbucks.com when you go in and you type 98005, and it tells you the nearest Starbucks is to
your zip code.
Okay, that's obvious.
Yeah.
But you're using geography. The application isn't running in a location. That's very different than what we think will happen, you know, at some point in the future, is when applications are geography aware.
Mm.
Right? Now, there are two categories. Yeah. Right? There's one category which applications are immersive. You are in a place from far away, which virtual 3D is sort of an example of. And it's a different category where you are in the world, and application just knows about the relation between you, the place in the world, and objects and people around you.
Okay.
So think about it as, we call this POP, or people, objects, places, right, and how they are interrelated.
Okay.
So if I know, if my application is aware of me having a cell phone, and where the cell phone is, and my friends and where their cell phones are, and my objects that I'm interested in. I don't know, maybe I'm answering this book that's coming out, and this Barnes & Noble's next to me has it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's in a place, so I now can relate the people to the object, to the place, in a smart way.
Understood. Right?
So, you know, one way to think about where applications can be smarter when you have a platform like this. Right, Eric, I'm going to be in Bellevue, you're going to be in Renmo, sorry. Right? So, let's say that's your location, that's my location. We want to meet for lunch. Well, guess what? You assign an hour for this, and I assign an hour. That's going to define some drive time circle. Of course, I'm drawing the circle, but it's not really as the Superman fly circle. It's based on traffic and driving rights. It's more like a crazy polygon, right, with highways sort of sticking out. But you get my point, right?
Yeah.
So there's an area that if we allow ourselves an hour and we want to eat for 30 minutes, we can meet. And then there are businesses here.
Sure.
Now, incidentally, there'll be I love sushi, which is very appropriate.
Yes.
Yeah. Which is actually, but the funny thing is that you can actually start to become a lot smarter. Right? This isn't driving directions right anymore. It's trying to stop thinking about information and think about knowledge. Right? What does it mean for me?
I understand.
What does
that
it mean for sort of groups?
But I guess my question, I mean, that's certainly obviously the computation of data for in interesting scenarios. I'm talking about these rather complex image. I guess what I'm really asking is why do I care what Las Vegas looks like from the sky. So how does that help me? How does it make me smarter?
First of all, we were the first to ship bird's eye, so we can look at the side of buildings and not only the... Right, so,
all right.
And we are still the only one with bird's eye. Google did counter us with street side. Right? Although we shipped it first, but they scaled it
fair
up
enough.
First. So,
yeah.
You know... look, if you are... if you need to quote someone what it costs to, you know, maintain the air conditioning units, you probably want pictures of the top. If you want to figure out, you know, if someone calls you and say, hey, I'm going to pay you, I'm going to charge you less to do window cleaning.
Okay.
Right? And, you know, how do you know? So I actually looked at your building and I measured it and I know what it is.
Aha.
Right? I don't need to be there to do it.
So you just lack, you lack imagination, Charles.
And fair enough.
Like, you know, the fact that there's this data around you, that allows you to kind of use it in unexpected ways. So.
Okay.
But this is the point, right? Yeah. I mean, you don't really know what... This is a platform.
Sure.
Right? It's trying to be a platform. It's yes, I know there's this live map thing. We're trying to, you know, build the key functionality out of it. But we'll only be successful if we do the traditional Microsoft thing. So, hey, there's 20 million developers, and they'll surprise the hell out of us. We don't really know what they're doing.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, it's obvious that, I mean, look, the late, great Jim Gray, right? One of the things he wanted to do with a bunch of this data was to take all the astronomical data, including tons of images.
That's served out of our system, by the way.
That's awesome.
I don't know if you know, but all the tiles for, you know, actually come out of the
Okay, now I like this now. I get it.
But so no, you care more about kind of your abstract things in space than your real, your own house?
Well, I mean, my point is that it's like, in some sense, my house, for example, I could say, hey, I could here's an example, right? Mm-hmm. I want you guys to paint my house. Well, what does it look like? Go here. Go to this address. I send them a URL. They click on it. They see my house. That's cool. What? However, what they didn't see was the fact that a woodpecker knocked the side of my house out, let's say, for example. That wasn't updated.
That's some nasty woodpecker.
Yeah. But you understand what I mean.
Completely. Let me give you an example. Okay? And maybe it's a crazy example because Google actually solves it better with street side today than we do, although we do okay with, with bird's eye. So if you were new to Seattle and you said, what should I do? I said, well, if you have some time, the traffic is not too bad over the bridge, go to Pike Place, walk around the market, then there's an Italian restaurant, 2nd Avenue, it's you're on Pike, just go south a couple of blocks. It's a big red door on the left side of the street, you find it wonderful. Get the pizza. Okay? Can you find... I don't know if this place exists. I'm just making it up.
Yeah.
Could you find it?
Could I find it?
Yeah.
Based
on instruction. Could you web search for it?
No, impossible.
Ah. Could you explore it on a map?
Yes.
Ah.
Okay,
so
I
this is
it.
Just search.
I understand.
You're just searching.
Or
the
you know
world.
What else I could do? It's just really revolutionary. Is I could drive there, park my car, and walk two blocks south on Pike and look around for a big red door.
Sure.
But I'm just saying, it's cool. I'm playing the devil's advocate.
Absolutely.
Here. That's all I'm doing.
But from one side, it's a platform. From the other side, this is a different way of searching.
Awesome.
Exploring instead of searching.
Cool. So you mentioned PhotoSynth before I randomized the conversation. That's incredibly interesting. Can we continue?
Yeah, sure. So the PhotoSynth team actually joined our team 6 or 8 months ago.
Uh-huh.
Blaze, who was the architect, actually is the MSN architect now. And we're working sort of very closely. You know, the teams are actually one larger team right now.
Excellent.
And PhotoSynth is going to be built into Virtual Earth.
Nice.
It's not only built into the consumer side. PhotoSynth is now also available on the Virtual Earth platform.
Hmm.
So enterprise customers... We use the platform, like all, you know, 80% of the real estate sites on the U.S. use Virtual Earth.
Nice.
So you imagine, instead of just having a dime slideshow, and now if PhotoSynth can walk through the house and
amazing.
See everything.
Incredible.
It's just a more immersive way of, you know, and something that we won't be able to ever scale with just cameras and airplanes. Yeah.
And so is that where you're kind of, we're talking about the tail, where,
that's
you
where
know, people
absolutely.
Kind of fill in the tail
how
with
you,
their own...
How do you get all the way? And of course, it also expands to the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Although, you know, there are many more people with cameras walking around than we can ever have these big, giant cameras with airplanes.
Mm.
Right. So and totally. You need, the answer is you need both.
I agree, but no, I love the PhotoSynth idea.
Yes, yeah. And so question there, right? So how would people kind of, you know, contribute their photos to this? How do that work? So do I have to kind of geotag them or
today you geotag? Today you geotag. You can actually say my PhotoSynth is over here, and then you can explore it in Virtual Earth. In the future, you can imagine automating it, right? So if we have enough scenes and enough 3D models of an area, then we can sort of do image matching. That's probably futuristic, but you know, just the fact that we can automatically construct 3D models in Virtual Earth, I assume you've seen this. Right?
Absolutely.
Right. I mean, that tells you that we can do a lot of image matching. That's very unusual, right? At some point, I think we did a little, you know, query for headcount, and we had about 1/3 of our developers had PhDs. which was amazing. Right? 260 developers, and 1/3 of them had PhDs.
That is impressive.
So it's a fun team to be on. Very challenging.
And Blaze is a super smart dude.
Absolutely.
Man.
It's a lot of fun to have him on the team.
I bet.
So, and how do you do when like, you know, you have like user contributed kind of, you know, pictures? How do you do quality control? How do you kind of, that there might be like, you know, digital vandalism, or, you know, it's like, you know, there's a picture of Charles House, so now I kind of, you know, take a picture of a really rundown house and I go, place it right there. It's like, look, Charles, where he lives. Yeah.
It doesn't scale. Right? It doesn't scale to go look at every upload. Facebook does look at every upload. There are people who just stare at every picture that comes through the system.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
They don't try to solve it. Windows Live Gallery, I believe, have something called a skin detector, and if the picture represents more than X% skin, then they have people look at it.
That's easy to work around. Anyway, okay, continue.
I'm not sure I like it.
Okay. Keep going.
Much separate discussion.
Thanks for letting me know. That's an easy algorithm.
There you go. Excellent. I'll tell the team. I think the right approach is, of course, to see if there's any voting algorithms that can either use the people who actually live there and know the neighborhood, right? Mm-hmm. Or you can compare to other examples, right? Which, of course, is susceptible to gaming, right? Let's say it's not enough for you to upload a picture because 5 other people upload a picture that doesn't agree with it. Mm-hmm. But what if 5 people gang up on Eric and all submit the same picture and his picture just gets voted off, right? And we have this empty... We have a crater in the center of your parking, your parcel. But look, you're trying to look at reasonable changes, right? It's unreasonable that one day there's a house and the second day there's nothing, right? So if it changes too much over time, there's some physical realities of what it means.
Sure.
In the future, and not that we're doing it, but we have some ideas how to do it. But the simplest example, I think, is just letting people know what's going on. So if there's a way to automatically notify Eric when someone uploads a picture that impacts him or about an area that he cares about, imagine that I had a geospatial lens that generates an RSS, a geo-RSS, something with support that said, anything that happens in this area, let me know.
Cool.
Just send me, it's in virtual today. You can use it right now.
Really?
You can put it on the
house. I never really use virtual Earth. I'll be perfectly frank.
Okay.
No offense, man. I don't use Google Earth either. Don't get me wrong. I'm old school, man.
Anytime you do explore collections, which looks at all the user community data, the little RSS button, click it.
Okay.
And you can select a query.
Right on.
The point is that at that point you can say, hey, people upload a thing. Let me look at them. And if you own them, you can disagree. You can vote them off the island.
Cool. So one other thing that was really interesting about Photosynth that Blaze talked about was sort of I guess this was done in partnership with UW at some point, but essentially the way that it was able to have an incredibly high-resolution image and intelligently send down chunks of it to clients.
That's actually CDON, which is something Blaze developed himself.
Agreed.
That was Blaze.
Did it on the weekends. Anyway, do you guys... But we own that technology now since we own Blaze. Are you guys using that in Virtual Earth today?
Yes, we are. So there's a Silverlight version of our map control, and internally uses something called Deep Zoom.
Yes.
Okay.
That's out in
beta. Developers can go play with it.
Awesome.
And you may imagine we'll use it in other places too.
Uh huh.
Right. So that's actually available for developers right now.
Cool.
And so do you have like the this thing already? Kind of, you know, with Photosynth, is that already available or?
From a perspective.
For like say that I want to kind of, you know, because, you know, I care about my house, you know, I want the roof of my house, so I would like to make some pictures.
All right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
you can do it now. That's been up for a while.
Okay.
And it's actually more than that. We also have a little, if you use the 3D version of Virtual Earth, you can create a 3D model of your house, and you can upload the model, not the house, not the pictures, right? So you can choose to, you know, be a 3D geek all the way and construct the model of your house and put it down and say, this is my true house. And then the woodpecker, you can go make change for that scenario before.
That was a
but you need to be a real geek for that. Or you can say, hey, there's the low effort version. I have a Canon, I'm going to capture some pictures.
Cool.
And this way, you know.
No, I mean, that's a really interesting idea. In fact, you could, if you wanted to spend the time, you could go, these people ask me the same directions all the time, right? Say when your family comes in. I'm going to go and I'm going to walk it and I'm going to take pictures, like a lot of pictures because I'm also a photographer. Then they're going to be able to actually path, like show in 3D. They can zoom around and figure out how they're actually going to do it.
Automatically.
Huh?
So once you created a collection photos in Virtual Earth, you can save it as a movie.
Perfect.
And you can upload to to whatever, Soapbox, YouTube, and you can share it and show you the movie, stop in the right places. That's been up for 6 months.
Okay, well, like I said, man, hey,
use it.
I'm old school, man.
Yeah. So another kind of, to talk about, like, something that we talked about before and with, like, pictures. So I think it's also quite interesting to kind of, be able to view the changes. Like, when you say Seattle changes, like, 5% every time. So is there a way to kind of see the kind of changes of the city over time? Do you kind of,
so
is there, like, the historical kind of,
So, unfortunately, most people want the latest information, not the historical information, except if they're insurance agents. Then they really, really want to see...
Before my house burned down,
What was there before, right? So they got to see, what is that car in the parking lot? Doesn't look like the Escalade, right? You weren't driving Escalade. Anyway, joking. But that's actually a feature that always gets asked for, but is one of these places where you have to think like a not-for-profit organization, in a sense, right? Because the cost is just as high. You're actually higher because most of this data is not digital. You have to go scan massive archives. There's actually a huge archive of most of the U.S. and most of Europe in the early 50s and late 40s after World War II.
Okay.
And it's hundreds of thousands of photos. It's amazing. From a historical perspective, it's tremendous. But it's just not something, there's no monetary value in it. There may be a lot of PR value and user interest value. You can't really commercialize. You can show relevant ads on Chicago in the 1940s. No, it doesn't work that way.
Depends. Maybe it's for, red wine or Italian restaurant. Santinis. Anyway,
Italian restaurants, yes. Red wine, Chicago, maybe. Yes. No, I like Chicago. It's beautiful. Yeah. So from that perspective, I think that it's definitely possible. It's definitely something we're hearing from people and definitely from insurance agents, but it's not something we're ever sort of getting to the product. But there's a different point here, right, which is architecturally the system can support generation. So I don't think there's a problem technically. It's just more how do you get the data in. But let's assume you actually don't have pixels, but you have data. What if you have sensors? That does exist many, many decades back, right? Mm-hmm. Can I ask questions and see how they work over time? Can I do queries on Virtual Earth as being the canvas? So Excel is an obvious way of doing these things on data. Mm. But I want to use the world as my data and then say pivot over time, pivot over distance.
Yeah,
pivot
that would over be population. Like, maybe like awesome. Temperature, right? I want to see how the temperature has changed over time,
Where should I region? Yes. Like, how much insurance, how much flood insurance should I buy for this house, right?
Yeah.
True. Is this house better or worse, right? Let me look at historical sea levels or rainfalls or flood or whatever. Mm-hmm. Let's see if I can make my own decision, not have to go to anyone else. So there is a project in Microsoft that is looking at that. It's very early. It'll take some time.
We will see them at some point.
We won't pre-announce anything before we're ready.
Good.
Right.
Very cool. This has been fun, man.
Yes. So I think we're kind of running out of time here.
Yeah.
So this is fantastic. So what is the kind of place that people should go to play with this?
They should go to maps.live.com. And they should also go to dev.live.com/virtualf, which is where the SDK is, and should play with it.
Okay.
And they'll find an interactive SDK where they can build map-based applications really, really quickly, both 2D, 3D, and the new Silhouette control. Use it. This is the biggest
use your imagination.
I'm going I'm going to hit the astronomy data.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. That's, by the way, a beautiful use of our backend infrastructure. Right. Yeah. I mean, they have this beautiful UI and beautiful data, and they just need a place to put it. Right. Yeah. And that wasn't even a blink on our system. Right. It was so low, so little data and so on.
Excellent.
Right. So it was a good working together. I think.
Great job, man.
Perfect. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And see you next time, right?
Yes, we will. Thank you for doing this, Eric. And great to meet you.
Appreciate it.
Great work, you guys.
Yeah, we're just starting.
Impressive technology.
Thank you.